The set text was prepared from the 1912 Gresham Publishing Company edition by David Price. Email ccx074@coventry.ac. Uck. Miscellaneous papers by Charles Dickens. Contents. The agricultural interest threatening letter to Thomas Hood from an ancient gentleman, crime and education, capital punishment, the spirit of chivalry in Westminster Hall in memoriam, W.M. Thackeray, Adelaide Ann Proctor, Chauncey Hare Townshend on Mr. Fector's acting, the agricultural interest, the present government, having shown itself to be particularly clever in its management of indictments for conspiracy, cannot do better, we think, keeping in its administrative eye the pacification of some of its most influential and most unruly supporters, than indict the whole manufacturing interest of the country for a conspiracy against the agricultural interest. As the jury ought to be beyond impeachment, the panel might be chosen among the Duke of Buckingham's tenants, with the Duke of Buckingham himself as foreman, and, to the end, that the country might be quite satisfied with the judge, and have ample security beforehand for his moderation and impartiality, it would be desirable, perhaps, to make such a slight change in the working of the law a mere nothing to a conservative government, bent upon its end, as would enable the question to be tried before an ecclesiastical court, with the Bishop of Exeter presiding. The Attorney General for Ireland, turning his sword into a plowshare, might conduct the prosecution, and Mr. Cobden and the other traversers might adopt any ground of defense they chose, or prove or disprove anything they pleased, without being embarrassed by the least anxiety or doubt in reference to the verdict. That the country in general is in a conspiracy against this sacred but unhappy agricultural interest, there can be no doubt. It is not alone within the walls of Covent Garden Theatre, or the Free Trade Hall at Manchester, or the Town Hall at Birmingham, that the cry repeal the Corn Laws is raised. It may be heard, moaning at night, through the straw-littered wards of refuges for the destitute. It may be read in the gaunt and famished faces which make our streets terrible. It is muttered in the thankful grace pronounced by haggard wretches over their felon fare in gaols. It is inscribed in dreadful characters upon the walls of fever hospitals, and may be plainly traced in every record of mortality. All of which proves that there is a vast conspiracy afoot against the unfortunate agricultural interest. They who run, even upon railroads, may read of this conspiracy. The old stagecoachman was a farmer's friend. He wore top boots, understood cattle, fed his horses upon corn, and had a lively personal interest in malt. The engine driver's garb, and sympathies, and tastes belonged to the factory. His fustian dress, besmeared with coal dust and begrimed with soot, his oily hands, his dirty face, his knowledge of machinery, all point him out as one devoted to the manufacturing interest. Fire and smoke, and red-hot cinders follow in his wake. He has no attachment to the soil, but travels on a road of iron, furnace-wrought. His warning is not conveyed in the fine old Saxon dialect of our glorious forefathers, but in a fiendish yell. He never cries, "Yip!" with agricultural lungs, but jerks forth a manufactured shriek from a brazen throat. Where is the agricultural interest represented? From what phase of our social life has it not been driven to the undue setting up of its false rival? Are the police agricultural? The watchmen were. They wore woolen nightcaps to a man. They encouraged the growth of timber by patriotically adhering to staves and rattles of immense size. They slept every night in boxes, which were but another form of the celebrated wooden walls of old England. They never woke up till it was too late, in which respect you might have thought them very farmers. How is it with the police? Their buttons are made at Birmingham. A dozen of their truncheons would poorly furnish forth the watchman's staff. They have no wooden walls to repose between, and the crowns of their hats are plated with cast iron. Are the doctors agricultural? Letmes. Morrison and Moat, of the hygiene establishment at King's Cross, London, reply. Is it not, upon the constant showing of those gentlemen, an ascertained fact, that the whole medical profession have united to depreciate the worth of the universal vegetable medicines? And is this opposition to vegetables, and exaltation of steel and iron instead, on the part of the regular practitioners, capable of any interpretation but one? Is it not a distinct renouncement of the agricultural interest, and a setting up of the manufacturing interest instead? Do the professors of the law at all fail in their truth to the beautiful, made whom they ought to adore? Inquire of the Attorney General for Ireland. Inquire of that honorable and learned gentleman, whose last public act was to cast aside the grey goose quill, an article of agricultural produce, and take up the pistol, which, under the system of percussion locks, has not even a flint, to connect it with farming. Or put the question to a still higher legal functionary, who, on the same occasion, when he should have been a reed, inclining here and there, as adverse scales of evidence disposed him, was seen to be a manufactured image on the seat of justice, cast by power, in most impenetrable brass. The world is too much with us in this manufacturing interest, early and late, that is the great complaint and the great truth. It is not so with the agricultural interest, or what passes by that name. It never thinks of the suffering world, or sees it, or cares to extend its knowledge of it, or, so long as it remains a world, cares anything about it. All those whom Dant placed in the first bitter circle of the doleful regions might have represented the agricultural interest in the present parliament, or at quarter sessions, or at meetings of the farmers' friends, or anywhere else. But that is not the question now. It is conspired against, and we have given a few proofs of the conspiracy, as they shine out of various classes engaged in it. An indictment against the whole manufacturing interest need not be longer, surely, than the indictment in the case of the Crown against O'Connell and others. Mr. Cobden may be taken as its representative, as indeed he is, by one consent already. There may be no evidence, but that is not required. A judge and jury are all that is needed. And the government know where to find them, or they gain experience to little purpose. Threatening letter to Thomas Hood from an ancient gentleman. Mr. Hood. Sir, the Constitution is going at last. You needn't laugh, Mr. Hood. I am aware that it has been going, two or three times before, perhaps four times, but it is on the move now, sir, and no mistake. I beg to say that I use those last expressions advisedly, sir, and not in the sense in which they are now used by jackanapeses. There were no jackanapeses when I was a boy, Mr. Hood. England was old England when I was young. I little thought it would ever come to be young England when I was old. But everything is going backward. Ah, governments were governments, and judges were judges, in my day, Mr. Hood. There was no nonsense then. Any of your seditious complainings, and we were ready with the military on the shortest notice. We should have charged Covent Garden Theatre, sir, on the Wednesday night, at the point of the bayonet. Then, the judges were full of dignity and firmness, and knew how to administer the law. There is only one judge who knows how to do his duty now. He tried that revolutionary female the other day, who, though she was in full work making shirts at 3/2 a piece, had no pride in her country, but treasonably took it in her head, in the distraction of having been robbed of her easy earnings, to attempt to drown herself and her young child. And the glorious man went out of his way, sir, out of his way, to call her up for instant sentence of death, and to tell her she had no hope of mercy in this world, as you may see yourself, if you look in the papers of Wednesday the 17th of April. He won't be supported, sir, I know he won't, but it is worth remembering that his words were carried into every manufacturing town of this kingdom, and read aloud to crowds in every political parlor, beer shop, newsroom, and secret or open place of assembly, frequented by the discontented working men, and that no milk and water weakness on the part of the executive can ever blot them out. Great things like that are caught up and stored up in these times and are not forgotten, Mr. Hood. The public at large, especially those who wish for peace and conciliation, are universally obliged to him. If it is reserved for any man to set the Thames on fire, it is reserved for him, and indeed I am told he very nearly did it once. But even he won't save the Constitution, sir. It is mauled beyond the power of preservation. Do you know in what foul weather it will be sacrificed and shipwrecked, Mr. Hood? Do you know on what rock it will strike, sir? You don't, I am certain, for nobody does know as yet but myself. I will tell you. The Constitution will go down, sir, nautically speaking, in the degeneration of the human species in England, and its reduction into a mingled race of savages and pygmies. That is my proposition. That is my prediction. That is the event of which I give you warning. I am now going to prove it, sir. You are a literary man, Mr. Hood, and have written, I am told, some things worth reading. I say I am told, because I never read what is written in these days. You will excuse me, but my principle is that no man ought to know anything about his own time, except that it is the worst time that ever was, or is ever likely to be. That is the only way, sir, to be truly wise and happy. In your station, as a literary man, Mr. Hood, you are frequently at the court of Her Gracious Majesty the Queen. God bless her. You have reason to know that the three great keys to the royal palace, after rank and politics, are science, literature, art. I don't approve of this myself. I think it ungenteel and barbarous, and quite un-English, the custom having been a foreign one, ever since the reigns of the uncivilized sultans, in the Arabian Nights, who always called the wise men of their time about them. But so it is. And when you don't dine at the royal table, there is always a knife and fork for you at the equerries table, where, I understand, all gifted men are made particularly welcome. But all men can't be gifted, Mr. Hood. Neither scientific, literary, nor artistical powers are any more to be inherited than the property arising from scientific, literary, or artistic productions, which the law, with a beautiful imitation of nature, declines to protect in the second generation. Very good, sir. Then, people are naturally very prone to cast about in their minds for other means of getting at court favor, and, watching the signs of the times, to hew out for themselves, or their descendants, the likeliest roads to that distinguished goal. Mr. Hood, it is pretty clear, from recent records, in the court circular, that if a father wished to train up his son in the way he should go to court, and cannot indenture him to be a scientific man, an author, or an artist, three courses are open to him. He must endeavor by artificial means to make him a dwarf, a wild man, or a boy Jones. Now, sir, this is the shoal and quicksand on which the Constitution will go to pieces. I have made inquiry, Mr. Hood, and find that in my neighborhood two families, and a fraction out of every four, in the lower and middle classes of society, are studying and practicing all conceivable arts to keep their infant children down. Understand me. I do not mean down in their numbers, or down in their precocity, but down in their growth, sir. A destructive and subduing drink, compounded of gin and milk in equal quantities, such as is given to puppies to retard their growth. Not something short, but something shortening, is administered to these young creatures many times a day. An unnatural and artificial thirst is first awakened in these infants by meals of salt beef, bacon, anchovies, sardines, red herrings, shrimps, olives, pea soup, and that description of diet, and when they screech for drink, in accents that might melt a heart of stone, which they do constantly, I allude to screeching, not to melting, this liquid is introduced into their too confiding stomachs. At such an early age, and to so great an extent, is this custom of provoking thirst, then quenching it with a stunting drink, observed, that brine pap has already superseded the use of tops and bottoms, and wet nurses, previously free from any kind of reproach, have been seen to stagger in the streets, owing, sir, to the quantity of gin introduced into their systems, with a view to its gradual and natural conversion into the fluid I have already mentioned. Upon the best calculation I can make, this is going on, as I have said, in the proportion of about two families and a fraction in four. In one more family and a fraction out of the same number, efforts are being made to reduce the children to a state of nature, and to inculcate, at a tender age, the love of raw flesh, train oil, new rum, and the acquisition of scalps. Wild and outlandish dances are also in vogue. You will have observed the prevailing rage for the polka, and savage cries and whoops are much indulged in, as you may discover, if you doubt it, in the House of Commons any night. Nay, some persons, Mr. Hood, and persons of some figure and distinction too, have already succeeded in breeding wild sons, who have been publicly shown in the courts of bankruptcy, and in police offices, and in other commodious exhibition rooms, with great effect, but who have not yet found favor at court, in consequence, as I infer, of the impression made by Mr. Rankin's wild men being too fresh and recent, to say nothing of Mr. Rankin's wild men being foreigners. I need not refer you, sir, to the late instance of the Ojibwe bride. But I am credibly informed that she is on the eve of retiring into a savage fastness, where she may bring forth and educate a wild family, who shall in course of time, by the dexterous use of the popularity they are certain to acquire at Windsor and St. James, divide with dwarfs the principal offices of state, of patronage, and power, in the United Kingdom. Consider the deplorable consequences, Mr. Hood, which must result from these proceedings, and the encouragement they receive in the highest quarters. The dwarf being the favorite, sir, it is certain that the public mind will run in a great and eminent degree upon the production of dwarfs. Perhaps the failures only will be brought up, wild. The imagination goes a long way in these cases, and all that the imagination can do, will be done, and is doing. You may convince yourself of this, by observing the condition of those ladies who... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.